Now, in 1914, the suffragist talks about April 11th issue, the nationwide demonstration to demand passage by Congress of the Bristow-Mandel suffrage bill.
Yes.
So if you can remember anything about the planning on that and how it was pulled off, it'd be interesting.
Which one was that? What
this was in April of 1914, and you wanted a demonstration in every state on May 2nd.
That's right.
And did you get one?
Oh, we certainly did. Lucy Burns went all over the country. I don't mean Lucy Burns, Crystal Eastman, who had come on our national board, went all over the United States, not all, but a considerable section, getting people to hold processions and meetings, whatever they could, for the original Susan B. Anthony Amendment, and then to send people to Washington for on May 2nd to have a big demonstration there, which they did. And this one, the second one, was very big, and you'll surely come across it here.
There are quite a few pictures in here in the May 9th issue of that.
May 2nd, have you gotten to?
And yes, here's May 2nd. From ocean to ocean, suffragists celebrate great day. Women from every congressional district to carry resolution to Washington on May 9th. Plans for procession to the Capitol.
Yes, that's right. And that's when we had one woman, I think, from every district. That's when the police, I told you the other night, when the police had more policemen out than we had, the papers said, and we had marchers, because we had it limited to one person for every district, and they had just a tremendous number trying to make a good reputation for the police department.
And it says here you sold your suffrages in cities all over the country, and the sales were most gratifying. And here's a song, March of the Women.
Yes.
That someone wrote.
You know what that is, don't you?
Ethel Smith.
You know what it
I've
is?
I've heard it.
You know what it is?
No.
Well, when the women were in prison in England, Dame Ethel Smith, who was given her title of Dame because of her reputation in the field of music, wrote this March of the Women. And wrote the music, of course, for March of the Women, and the words for the March of the Women. And from that time on, it was sung in every... It was sung when I was back in England, and in the suffrage days over there. It was sung always in prison by all the suffragists, and everywhere at every meeting and so on. So then I knew about it, having been over there, so we brought it over here and had it sung at our meetings. And we still do.
Oh.
And the words are wonderful, you know. Life, strife, these two are one. The words are superb in that.
Yeah.
I think. And the music is stirring.
Yes, it is. I think Consuela has recorded
that. Yes, she used it.
Here's a picture on the front of your May 16th volume of the head of the Congressional Union procession to the Capitol on May 9th. So May was certainly your month. And here's this enormous crowd in front of the Capitol.
You see why we're so exhausted.
Yeah.
You see why I have a block on my heart, the doctor says.
I can see why your heart is tired. Well, it wasn't, but 1914 seems to me to be an important year because that was when you really started working on your holding the party in power responsible and you began to influence elections.
Well, it's the first election campaign that occurred after we were created.
Yeah.
We couldn't do it before.
Yeah. Right. Now, did you have any opposition to that idea?
Yes, tremendous.
Oh, you did?
We had opposition to everything we did. Everything.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant within your own councils when you were planning
no,
it?
Did own, you have any our own people, we were the same type of people. We got on all right. We didn't ever have any opposition on anything.
Mm.
We adopted this program at this meeting up at Mrs. Belmont's, you know.
Oh, yes.
I think we
did. At Marble House?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And we called this meeting. It was a meeting of our, I think our executive board and our National Advisory Council, I think. And we laid before the women. I presided the meeting and gave the outline of what we wanted to do, and Lucy Burns, who'd been doing most of the congressional work, made the splendid speech showing how the Democrats had caucused against us and as a whole body, and we couldn't start and support individual people even though they were for us when they belonged to a caucus that had taken the action against us and so on. So this vote went unanimously through. And we had a great many people there who were from the old National American. For instance, Mrs. Hepburn, although their branch didn't do what her sister's branch did, withdraw from the National American, she went to this conference and voted for this. And I remember she wrote me afterwards and said, "This is the way you swept everybody, the way you and Lucy Burns with your program swept us all completely into this movement, something I was very much impressed by," or something like that.
Mm.
So she was wholeheartedly, and she was the great power up in this state.
Mm.
Even though, so they had this dissension, of course, all the time in their old National American, with trying to get the, so many women trying to get the National American to stand with us, which they didn't succeed in doing.
Mm. National American had promised cooperation in this nationwide demonstration in May. Did they cooperate?
Well, I remember when they when we had this, they had some kind of a float. Maybe it shows them on the pictures, I don't know. Showing their support of the Shuttleworth Palmer.
Oh.
Putting it in our demonstration.
That wasn't quite what you had in mind, was it?
Well, most of the people had looked on had no idea what was the Shuttleworth
yeah.
Palmer. It didn't make much difference. We didn't worry about it. They got us more people.
Well, at this Newport meeting at Mrs. Belmont's Marble House, my notes mention also that there was $7,000 raised. And
Mrs. Belmont gave $5,000 after we had announced our program and so on. She got up and, and offered $5,000, which she paid.
May I ask you one more question that isn't quite clear to me?
Have you gone all through these records in the suffragists that you asked
me
about?
Yes, I have.
The things you're asking me about, have you gone through?
I've read this suffragist.
The one that you question you asked me, that period you've covered, have you?
Yes. And then there's one other thing that I want to ask you. The suffragist says that on this May 9th, mass meeting and so forth in Washington, there were 531 delegates from states that presented resolutions to the Committee of Senators and Congressmen, which then were introduced on the floor of each House, that this was the first time that suffrage had been up for debate on the floor of the House, although Congressman Henry would not let the Rules Committee meet on it at first. But this was the beginning, I guess, of that. Is that the right impression? That the petitions were presented to the senators and congressmen, and then it was introduced into each house, or was it? That sounds a little bit like it was.
Well, I think the petitions were presented in the support, of course. Usually, you get your resolution introduced at the beginning of each Congress. I have to imagine we did.
Yeah. And that this.
I think we
asked. The purpose of this May.
Was to back it up.
March was to back it up and make a demonstration of support.
That's
for
right.
It. Okay.
All the demonstrations were for that purpose.
Yeah.
The only thing we changed in that was finally we gave up Bristol Mundell's name and put Susan B. Anthony.
Yeah. Okay.
In our demonstrations.
Then I wanted to ask you about the formation of an advisory council.
What year was that?
This was 1914, and Harriet Stanton Blatch joined it in September, and you had a lot of famous women on it from all over the nation. So I wonder if this was an effort on your part to get a wider base of support
for
your organization.
Mrs. Blatch may have founded it, but the principal person...
No, I didn't say she founded it. I just know that she joined it in September. That's all I know.
Oh, she joined it. Well, the person who was the chairman, and I thought she was always the chairman, but maybe she wasn't in the beginning, was a Mrs. Elizabeth Rogers, the one I told you went with me to Simpson. Mm-hmm. She worked always as the chairman of our advisory council. Everything we did, we'd have the advisory council there.
Yeah. In getting an advisory council like that together, it takes a great amount of contacting women. And I noticed they were from all different walks of life.
Yes.
Could you give us any idea of how on earth you'd go about something like that?
Well, we got a chairman, the one that we wanted to be a chairman. And I think it was Mrs. Rogers. I don't remember any other chairman. Then she, of course, would write to people she knew. She was very well known, and her family, Secretary of War Simpson, was very well known. She had many connections. She got together herself.
And Alice...
And if we heard of other people, if anybody heard of somebody she thought would be nice to get as a member, but she would not be likely to do any work, say so, some writer or somebody who's... some woman physician or something, someone who was well known, but we didn't believe she'd do very much work, and we'd ask her to go on the advisory council.
I see. So how did you use this council then? Just as names for...
No, it was really... just recall, I'm almost sure they were at this meeting in Newport, and I think they were at every meeting we ever had.
Oh. So that they really did participate,
yes,
and gave ideas.
And they were willing to do that, you see, to come to a meeting when a decision was to be made.
Yeah.
It was a very useful organization.
Well, the other things that I would just like to hear you talk about, how you handled the Democratic women in trying to get them to campaign against their Democratic candidates and holding the party in power responsible.
You mean in the suffrage states?
In the suffrage states, yes.
Well, and we just used the argument, same argument we did with that all women. The women who had the vote now had the obligation, we thought, and anyway they had the opportunity to, more than anybody else, to enfranchise the rest of the women in the country. And we would appeal to them to use their votes in a way that would help. And we'd point out that the administration was formally against the enfranchisement of women. And if they voted for that administration, they were voting against the freedom of women. That's all there was to it. And you see, we got people to go into each one of these election campaigns, we got women to go into every state who believed this and who could get up and say it. And that way we turned a great many votes.
Yeah.
Didn't have to turn enough to defeat a man if he just felt that there was an unrest among his women on his subject.
Mm-hmm.
Then it would be probable that when he came back he would use his influence in his party to stop this opposition. Which was the case, that did happen.
Did you run into a sticky problem of having to campaign against a Democrat who had worked hard for the amendment?
Well, I don't know anybody ever worked hard, but...
Or who had supported you in Congress?
But of course we didn't in the separate states, because everybody was supporting us in Congress from a separate state.
Did you lose any friends in Congress?
I don't think we did. It made people very angry, but I think they... Of course they were angry when we diminished their support in their own states.
Mm-hmm.
But still, they would probably always keep on being for the amendment because the women were voting, and they didn't want to, very few men wanted to go against the votes for women in the state where women were voting.
Yeah.
course, in the Senate, Senator Borah did go against this, vote against it. I think he was the only senator from a separate state that did.
Mm-hmm. Why did he? What on earth was his reason, do you know?
I don't know why he did.
Mm-hmm. See, there was another question on my mind about that. Oh.
What he said publicly was that he thought he was for it, and he thought that people should get it the same way Idaho did by their state referendum.
Oh, the same states' rights thing.
That what he said is a defense. That's why I really was against that. I don't know. We had an organizer, Margaret Whittemore, who went out to that state of Idaho. And I remember she went down to the Capitol, and where you could look at the, in that state, to the signatures of the men who were running and see what they put themselves down as supporting. In Idaho, they did this. And he put himself down as supporting the National Suffrage Amendment. And he came to see me personally in our headquarters in Washington and said the same thing, that he was supporting this. And he wanted us to know and to not continue any opposition, which we were having in the beginning, against him. He came into our office and sat down and took a long talk and told me this. And he told the senators this. And when this measure came up for a vote in the Senate, when we were almost at the point we thought of winning, and that must have been 1918, I guess. I think it was in the winter. Maud Younger and I sat up, she was our congressional chairman, you know, and a wonderful chairman. We sat up together in the gallery, and we thought the vote was going to be taken in the Senate. We thought we had the vote, exactly, but not won over. And she knew every man so intimately. She made that her business, just to know them thoroughly, and personally, and socially, and their wives, and everything. And so she was, on the strength of her report, and our own general information, we thought we could risk the vote. So, as we sat there, and from all over the country women came, it was packed and jammed with people from great distances who came for this first vote of the Senate on the Equal Rights Amendment. Maybe there'd been one Equal Suffrage Amendment. Maybe there had been earlier ones when it wasn't going to really be passed, but this was the first one when it looked as though it would go through. So, finally, when all these speeches went on and on and on and on and on and no vote was being taken, Maud Younger and I went down to see what the trouble was. And we went up to Senator Curtis, who was the Republican whip from Kansas, later the vice president, you know, under Hoover, and Senator Gallinger from New Hampshire, who was the Republican leader of the Senate. And this was when the Republicans were in control. So we went up to them, and there they were, both each one standing side by side with a tally sheet in their hands. And we said, well, why in the world don't you vote? All these women are assembled to hear the vote, and it's going on and on. And they said, well, Borah has left us. Said we thought we had. We said we think we have the votes, and they said that we think you had the votes too. We thought you had the votes, and we knew you had the votes, and we were planning to take the vote. But he said when Borah told us that he had decided to vote against it, we knew we couldn't carry it because we'd be one vote short. And so he said we have instructed all our leaders on the floor of the Senate to just keep on talking, get as much enthusiasm for it as they can, and then that the time will be up and they will move to adjourn, because we don't want to be voted down, which would be very harmful to you and to the Republican Party. We don't want it to happen. So we agreed with them, and that was the best thing to do and the only thing to do. So nobody really knows what happened to Borah, because we'd had his pledge when he came to this office personally. He took the trouble to come to an unimportant group and sit down and tell their chairman that he was going to vote for this measure, please not to make any more trouble in his state. And he went down and signed it, and this Miss Whittemore, I'm sure, was correct when she said she read it and saw his name assigned, things he would support. And then he told his own Democratic whip, I mean Republican whip, and his own Republican leader, Gallinger, because they said he told them he'd vote for it. Then he didn't. So that postponed our Senate victory for maybe half a year.
In, after had your...
I guess you haven't come to that yet in the suffrages.
Not yet. After you had your first election success in 1914, the amendment, which had been bottled up in Congressman Henry's Rules Committee all that year, was suddenly voted out without recommendation. He let it come out to a vote on the committee, and they voted it out on the floor without recommendation to the House. Now,
the purpose was to start to speed it up.
Do you see that as a direct connection to your work in...
Well, we knew it was, of course. Because if you get on the Rules Committee, there were a good many men, Republicans and Democrats, and if they think, they see signs of their women wanting something and expressing it in their votes. You see, some of the senators and congressmen did have their votes diminished. I don't know whether any of them were defeated because of this, but anyway, they were strengthened, and they knew it, and they knew, they always said so, they blamed it on us. Gallagher read me something I hadn't known, and I don't know where he got it from, but one of these books probably, a statement by Mr. Taggart of Kansas. I don't know whether you'll come across it.
In the hearing?
No, in the result of the election. Mr. Taggart made this statement, furious statements against us, and violent statements against us, that we had gone in and poisoned the minds of the women in his state, and so on, so on, so. He was from Kansas.
Yes.
And, but then, as far as I know...
Alice, he raked you over the coals pretty hard in a hearing. I don't know whether you remember it or not.
Who did?
I think it was Taggart. I've got a little...
Well, that's the man, yes.
Yeah, and it was reprinted. The transcript of the hearing was reprinted in the Suffragist. Yeah. It was in 1915, because it was after your 1914 election.
Because we... A 1914 election.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because we...
He was really upset about it.
Well, we thought that it was good evidence that it was... We put in to encourage the women. It was good evidence to show that when they deflected on this subject, it was making the congressman give real serious attention to the subject.
Yeah. Now that I've said it was in 1915, I'm not sure. It could have been 19.
We didn't have any election campaign in 15, it was 14.
I know it, but this hearing was right after the turn of the year.
Yes, that might have been.
In the following year.
Very likely.
And just for the record, I'll have to go in there and look at my the pages of the suffragists, but it may have been right after the 1916 election.
Well, whichever it was.
But it was a hearing, and
it was the same thing.
Upset.
We kept up the policy till the end, you see.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it was a very effective policy, because it was an appeal to the solidarity of women, to all the highest motives they could have in voting, and it lifted the whole thing up to a great principle, where they were standing for a great principle, we thought, anyway, and they thought so too, evidently, that they would put this principle above everything else, above their party and everything else. And it was inevitable that it would have an effect on the congressmen. We didn't care very much whether we defeated them or didn't defeat them. We knew anyway, whichever we did, they would still probably vote as the women of the state wanted, which would be for it.
Yeah.
And I don't remember any man from the suffrage states who voted against accepting Borah. And he made it clear that he wasn't voting against us, he was only voting for state referendum. To get it the same way Idaho had gotten it.
Yeah.
But I think he must have had some other motive.
And there must be a story there that we don't know. There was another group of states. I thought that I detected, as I read through the suffragists, a note of encouragement and so forth every time a southern chapter or something good would happen in the southern states, that there was kind of a little note of look, the South is coming around, if I read between the lines correctly. And I wanted to check with you on this. What was the South a little bit more difficult than other areas to get women's suffrage established in because of the race question?
Well, I don't think the race question would have come into it. Maybe the general conservatism of the South.
Well, there was There was an editorial about how national suffrage would not affect the white supremacy in the political world in the South. And I thought maybe that editorial wouldn't have been necessary if this hadn't have been a problem.
Maybe, but it wasn't anything that was very serious. We just knew we had to go everywhere.
Yeah.
And if we went to one state, there'd be some difficulties, another state, another difficulty. But now I went down myself and formed a branch in Florida, and we got one of the best members we've ever had in the whole Woman's Party's history, and that was Helen Hunt West, who later became the editor of our Equal Rights magazine, when we got an Equal Rights magazine after the suffragists. And we got with that same meeting, we got somebody to come up, and she was the oldest picket, and she was arrested and imprisoned.
Oh, yes. I remember reading.
And then I went myself to Texas and formed that branch, and we got one of the strongest branches in the country through this Mrs. Clara Snell Wolfe. Mm-hmm. And she got all these Maverick people in, and Lola Maverick Lloyd, and all these people whose children are still helping us.
Yeah.
And South Carolina, we, by correspondence, not even going there, we got Anita Pollitzer, who just became a backbone almost of our movement. She came, you know, from Charleston.
Oh, I see. Well, it seemed that there might be two...
And from Tennessee, for instance, excuse me one word, one minute, we got Sue White. We went down there. One of our members went. I think Maud Younger went down there and had a meeting, and she got Sue White to come up and stay at the headquarters and give up all her work. She had been a court stenographer. So she came up, and she just devoted herself to the campaign, and she was one of those who burned the president's words in front of the White House, which was one of the hardest things anybody could have done. And that was, she was from Tennessee, another southern state, you see. So I could go through all the southern states and tell the very strong supporters we had.
Well, I thought that there might have been two other issues that kept infringing, or impinging is my word, on the suffrage issue. One of them was the southern issues of states' rights and race relations, and the other one was the prohibition issue, liquor.
Well, the liquor interests were always considered, and many people still believe it's the main source of opposition. I don't know very much about the liquor interests, but they always spoke, had a formal representative, publicly representing them, speaking against the amendment at every hearing, as far as I can recall. And, of course, many people thought it was a very powerful opposition. I don't know that it was so much. They thought women would be the temperate half of the world, you know, and they didn't want to give them more power. And then this other one about states' rights, there was no question that the states' rights movement, of course, it was embodied in the old National American Woman Suffrage position. The women themselves were divided. Yeah. I told you that how that Mrs. Helen Gardner withdrew publicly from us and personally from us on the ground that she discovered we were really in earnest about putting the amendment in the Constitution and didn't appear again until the vote was won, when she appeared at the meeting giving them the pens, I believe, for the proclamation. I told you all that.
Yeah.
There's no question about that opposition. It was the voice of the president himself.
What do you mean, giving them the pens?
I told you how President Wilson assembled a group of people the night that the proclamation was issued. And, you know, they always sign it, then they give the pen to one pen to one person, one to another. Everybody goes away with the pens signed to some important document. So the people he assembled there were states' rights women who had opposed us.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know whether all of them were states' rights people, but probably they all were. Those I knew about were. And the other thing you said about the racial... I want to tell you that it was formed, and you probably know this, sometime while we were having the suffrage campaign, I guess, National Association of Colored Women was his name. And I guess you know all this. By Mary Church Terrell, who was the first Negro woman ever to graduate from a college, and she graduated from Oberlin. She married a judge in Washington, appointed by one of the presidents, a Negro judge. And she got together a group of women, and it's still the largest and most important group of colored women in the country, called the National Association of Colored Women. Well, they supported us always. First, our first procession, we had a group from Howard University, which Elsie Hill organized, went over there and spoke to them and got these colored women to come. Mm-hmm. And at that first, the only thing that brought dissension into our first procession. Did I ever told you about it?
No.
Well, she went there and organized these women and got them to come. And not this National Association of Colored Women, but that just the women in Howard. And she was having this section herself of college women. So she did that in connection with this, invited the college women in Howard University to come, all of whom were Negroes. So they accepted and became one of the group getting this up. And when this became public, I began to receive letters from many, 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 many splendid supporters we had, saying this is unheard of. We're certainly not going to come up and march in a procession where you have colored women marching. And it reached the newspapers, and they played it up to the utmost to get the dissension sowed in our ranks. And it was quite a problem. It was extremely difficult because we had so many women saying, there'll be nobody from our town, there'll be nobody from our state if you do this. Then with lots coming forth in the papers, inflaming everybody about the subject. Mm-hmm. It was a very difficult situation. Mm-hmm. And so I remember how we finally solved it. We had if I recall rightly, and I'd have to check this, but I think we had a men's section in this first procession. And I think these men were gathered together by a Quaker man whom I knew, whom I think was a distant relative of mine, named Mr. I won't put his name, because I might be mistaken. And so this man said, well, now, our group could be placed right next to the colored women, because we have no objection to whatsoever. We don't believe anything at all about this fuss over this colored women's delegation. And so it's my dim recollection, if only Elsie Hill were living, I could ask her all these things that I don't remember. I think in her college section, which was my section that I worked in, as I told you, that we had this colored group, and it's possible that they had a whole separate section of colored women, but I think they were in the college section. Not sure about that, but there was a colored section anyway, a section of colored women. And so we put this men's group next to them. And so the men's group were perfectly polite and finally everybody calmed down and accepted it. And so it was this men's group that really saved the day for us.
Yeah. Well,
and I want to tell you, this National Association of Colored Women that Mrs. Mary Church Terrell formed came in, and during the course of our suffrage fight, which came in later than this first procession, but from that time they joined us, I mean came in as supporters, they've always stood by us up till the present time.
I saw your problem not as being one of lack of support by the blacks, but as one of...
it wasn't that. It was lack of support by the white
whites.
Women.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Because they didn't want any more voting in the South.
No, it wasn't ever that. I never heard about that before. It's the first time I've ever heard anybody say that. What they didn't want... Mm-hmm. There were not so many people, black people, voting anyway because they had this grandfather's clause and various things,
yeah.
You know.
Right.
They didn't worry about that at all. What they worried about was being personally associated in any way with these colored women. It was that ground they left us. They never finally left, but that they threatened to leave.
You mean in the organization?
Well, it came up about our first procession.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
They weren't parts of our organization.
But after that...
These white women were parts of our organization, but the colored women who were coming in were not parts.
But apparently your workers in the South were finding that the opposition was saying that if woman suffrage amendment passed, this might increase the number of Negro voters in the South. And the editorial that I read in the Suffragist, which was on November 14th, 1914 issue, page 3, it pointed out these things, that that white women voters in Dixie will outnumber Negro women 2-1. And besides that, the property and literacy tests rule out Negro voters anyway, usually. And in states where there are more Negroes than whites, white supremacy could continue to be maintained by the same means as now prevails in these states, and therefore would not bring any alteration in the proportions of the black-white vote.
I think I probably wrote that editorial because I wrote almost all the editorials in the first few years of the amendment.
And it had
a little chart to show the voters. I don't think I ever personally thought that this was a serious matter. It was something, somebody was always bringing up some objection, you had to answer it.
Yeah. I have a half a paragraph of little notes here on the opposition, and I thought maybe you could fill out the picture. There was an opposition paper called The Woman Patriot, which was financed by a rich man named Wadsworth. And somewhere I picked up a note that this was a part of the Alice Longworth crowd.
Well, no, Wadsworth, you know, was the senator from New York, and then later defeated and was the congressman from New York, one of the most powerful men in Congress. And his wife, Mrs. James Wadsworth, was the president of the Association Against Votes for Women. They appeared at every hearing. They were powerful women, wealthy women, and a powerful organization. And all over the country they had these branches. You know, it was a very big force we were up against. And this was the leading, the crystallization of the opposition by the leaders of this group all over the country.
Did this hit its peak in 1914, 15, and 16?
Was this the increase?
Yeah, did it hit its peak in the years of 1914, 15, and 16?
Well, I should say it had its peak when the vote was taken in the House of Representatives. It was always apparently well financed and extremely active and led by very prominent women, and who sincerely believed it was for the benefit of the country not to have the vote for women. Now, what happened was they withdrew from the campaign, and I hope you'll read this when you get to it, and it'll be in the 1919 issue. Have you read that yet?
I did, but it's been years ago, Alice.
Well, you haven't read it right now, since I've been here.
I've read a few pages in it, but go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, when the vote was taken in the House of Representatives, the first time it was taken twice, and the first time was, I think, was in the spring of 1919, but you can find it there in the Suffragist. And in order to defeat the amendment, a man from Ohio who was known to be a good opponent and considered an opponent, naming, I think his name was Gard, G-A-R-D, and I have to verify these things, but I think it was that. Congressman Gard got up and offered an amendment to the Susan B. Anthony amendment before them for a vote, you see.
Oh, yes.
And maybe you saw this, saying the amendment was to require ratification within 7 years. And the reason for this was that the Prohibition Amendment had gone through with that addition, and there had never been one before.
Mm-hmm.
And that was put in by the saloon keepers and so on to try to get the Prohibition Amendment defeated. And so this, the anti-suffrage movement then adopted the same tactics and tried to put this amendment through. And all over the hall, cries came up of shame that they knew what he was doing, trying to defeat it by this. And so it was voted on. This amendment of Mr. Gard was voted on and turned down, defeated. So then they had the original amendment, the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex, with no limitation on it in any way. Just what we had wanted. And then I think I told you all this before. Well, then Mrs. Wadsworth, president, and you'll find this in the suffragists because I looked it up in our recent fight to keep the 7 years out of ourselves. I looked up to check on what happened. And Mrs. Wadsworth issued a statement right after the defeat of this measure to put the 7 years on, saying that we realize that it's useless to go on any longer in opposing the Equal Suffrage Amendment, now that the 7 years clause has been omitted. Because without the 7 years clause, the women, if they don't win this year, they could go on next year and next year and next year until they do win. And there's no question it will go into the Constitution. So we have decided to withdraw from the campaign against it. And so it was very wonderful for us, because throughout this whole ratification campaign, we never had a whisper from any of these powerful women and the well-financed women, well-financed organization of the League Against the Votes for Women, because of Mrs. Wadsworth's withdrawal of the whole organization from any further opposition. She said it's useless. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely useless. They have won by defeating that 7 years, and that's what I couldn't ever seem to get over to any of our women,
that
by putting the 7 years on, they were doing exactly what our opponents tried in vain to do back with the suffrage campaign, and that the leader of the campaign against Votes for Women, much more powerful than any leader we have now against it, withdrew and said, we'll give up the battle now. We won't go into any campaign. And we went to all these states and we never had anybody opposing.
Mm-hmm.
Other people opposed as individuals, but we never had that group of women opposing, which was our most formidable opposition.
Yeah. And that 7-year clause now just gives hope to the opponents of the ERA.
Is what?
I said that 7-year clause now gives hope to the opponents of the ERA.
Well, give hope to anybody that has
just
to try to put something over that's difficult to put over.
Yeah.
If you limit the time in which you can oppose, you limit yourself, you see.
Did you ever have any indications that some of the money for these antis came from liquor interests?
Came where?
From liquor interests. That some of the money that Wadsworth crowd.
We don't know where they got it from. They were all wealthy women, that type of women.
They had money anyway.
I don't know. We had no idea, but the liquor interests were totally different. They had a personal motive. They thought women would be so given to temperance that their own business interests would be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.